From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the program, we'll look back at 20 years of transformation in South Africa since Nelson Mandela became president. Later, the Brewers slow down a bit after a fast start to the season. Should Milwaukee baseball fans be worried?
In the grand scheme of things, this is not a cause for panic. The Brewers are still a very good team. They're not as good as they were in April. They're not as bad as they've been recently. They'll settle somewhere in the middle.
And finding good summer movies, critic Dave Lurson says there's reason for hope.
Summers are never a complete wasteland. I mean, you know, if you just look at what's in the top five, sometimes it would seem that way. But if you look around a little deeper in a city like Milwaukee, where we have the Downer and Oriental Theater and other venues from time to time, you can find something.
Lake Effect comes your way next after news from NPR and Milwaukee Public Radio. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for being with us today. 20 years ago this weekend, Nelson Mandela was sworn in as president of South Africa. It was a pinnacle of a period of remarkable change in that country that included Mandela's freedom from prison after 27 years and the end of the apartheid era, in which blacks and other non-white South Africans were denied the rights and freedoms that whites had. Mandela won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1993. He was elected president a year later. While he left office in 1999 and died last year, the period of change he helped usher in still defines much about South Africa today, but not everything. Vuyiswa Tulelo has experienced that change, and now she's helping to shape her country's future. Tulelo grew up as apartheid ended and Mandela came to power. She's now Consul General for South Africa in the Midwest, based in Chicago. She tells Lake Effect's Bonnie North that her country is now about more than its past.
I usually say that for people to appreciate South Africa, you have to go and be with the people. One of the things that I found is the more I speak to people in the United States and I say I'm from South Africa, the first thing they say is Cape Town, Johannesburg. And I tell them that's not where the real South Africa is, because that's an equivalent of your Milwaukee, your Chicago, your New York. If you want to see the transformation that has taken place in South Africa, go to the townships, go to the rural communities. Realize that in 20 years, you've walked from a situation where white children would never set foot in the township to where they go for sleepovers in the township. You have come from a situation from where white people, irrespective of their economic status, would never live in the township, to a situation where now they live in an RDP house, which is afforded by government, their neighbors being predominantly black people. That's how far South Africa has come in this past 20 years. You've gone from a situation where schools were not on the basis of your intellectual capacity, but on the basis of the financial stability that your parents had, to where young people get bursary scholarships to be able to go to the best schools, not because of who they are or what the color of their skin is, but because of what is between their ears.
So it sounds that in that 20 years, there has been a huge amount of change and growth for the positive. How has the culture fared with that? Sometimes it takes a while for people to catch up to their own culture when it changes that quickly.
It is true. It is true. And I always make this example. I say that if you were in South Africa today and you met two young people who were born in 1994, let's say who were born in July 1994, they are preparing to turn 20 in July of this year, and you ask them who their best friend is, you would probably be surprised to hear what comes out of their mouth, because you would be sure that you are speaking to a young person in Milwaukee. They are so integrated into the global village that their South Africanness is only realized by those who have grown up around them and by those who've brought them up. So for the younger generation, they have really taken it to the next level. The people who are still suffering are the older generations, those who benefited of apartheid, those who are perpetuating apartheid, because they know where they come from. And they can't stand it to see their grandchildren walking hand in hand in the streets of South Africa with a black child. They can't stand it to see their grandchild in a preschool playing with another black child and saying, oh, this is my best buddy, because of where they come from and what they know happened in South Africa. And we have the middle age group, which is like my parents. They are struggling because although they did not really get the cold end of apartheid, but they really felt apartheid because they were the last breed of your Bantu education. And they have moments where they celebrate and they realize where South Africa has gone to, but they also have moments where they're trapped in a realization that, but our children are free. My mother lives with me in Chicago. And she is amazed every time when she meets someone or some of my colleagues in town with me, and they come to me and they say, oh, CG, and it would be a white woman. And she's like, you know, when I was your age, Vuyiswa, I had to bow down to the white woman. Now you have the white woman bowing down to you. And that's how far South Africa has come. But we have to realize that it is not a global thing. It is a generational thing. So you have to go back. You have to go to what we refer to as the born freeze to see the actual effects of freedom and see my mother and realize how she has been able to free herself from the boundaries of working for the white woman and respecting the white woman to being an equal citizen in her country with the white woman.
What does that mean for what it means to be South African? When you look at these 20-year-olds, and I know you've worked with a lot of youth, that has been something that has been really important in your career. How do you think they're going to define what being South African is for them?
I will tell you the truth, and it scares me because I look at my children. I have a 5-year-old and a 7-year-old. And I realized that their notion of South Africanness is completely different from mine. My notion is still hinged on the fact that, yes, I'm South African, but I'm a Xhosa. I want people to understand that I come from a specific ethnic group. My children only know that they're South African, and that's what is important. So if I walk with them in a store, if I go to the park with them, and their accent is American, but my accent is a little bit different, and people say, who is that? And they say, oh, it's my mommy. Where do you come from? And they say, oh, we're South African. That's what they know. So if you look at this born free generation, they know that they are South African. They really don't have that hold on their ethnicity, on their culture, because of the global village that they live in. Their only understanding is that they were born in South Africa and they compete with the world on an equal footing, as opposed to my generation. Yes, we were the ones who received the first freedom of a new South Africa, but we're still entrenched in where we come from. So if you meet me and a white South African woman who is the same age as I am, we would probably say, oh, I'm Xhosa, and the other one would say, oh, I'm Afrikaans, the other one would say, oh, I'm English, before we say we are South African. But I can promise you this, in 20 years' time, you would have difficulty telling who is Xhosa, Zulu, Venda in a South African community, because their focus would be on their South Africanness and not their ethnical or cultural backgrounds.
But do you lose something when you lose that connection to your ethnicity?
You do. You do. And again, using my children as a case scenario, my daughter, who is 7, is starting to lose our local dialect. She can hear you when you're speaking Xhosa, but she's unable to respond as frequently as she used to do. My boy is like in a pitch dark room. He don't know what you're talking about. And we speak Xhosa in the house all the time. And he looks at us and is like, why are you talking that strange language? And there is a good part of it, because he's in a free world. He gets the best education. He gets the best infrastructure. He can compete with other young people equally. But there is the part that he loses part of who he is. In this new democracy, we are creating this child that we cannot describe, whether they're South African, American, European, or what is it. And when you ask them, who are you? You know, in our cultures, when you introduce yourself, you say, you asked me, what's my name? I say to you, I'm Vuyiswa Tulelo. That's how the Western society does. But in our cultures, when you ask me who I am, before I tell you what my name is, I have to tell you where I come from. I have to tell you who my parents are, who my parents' parents are, where they were born, where they were brought up, if I had any heroes or heroines in my bloodline, and then tell you I am the daughter of this clan. And we're losing that beautiful aspect of who we are.
You talked about young people taking advantage of what South Africa has to offer in terms of economics. What is the state of small business development in South Africa. I know you guided young entrepreneurs in South Africa before. Are things good? Are things looking good?
This morning before I came here, I switched on WTT, I think it's a public channel in Chicago, and BBC World Focus on Africa was playing. And they had this 10-minute advert of different strands of young people in South Africa who were saying in their own words how democracy has worked for them. And the one that stood out for me was this young couple. They are in their early 20s. They are both chartered accountants. Now, firstly, you would never find a chartered accountant that is black in South Africa, especially a woman. Now you have a young woman with her husband who are both chartered accountants who are going into your previously white suburbs to go and look for a house. And she said, if it was not for this democracy in South Africa, I would not have had the access to education. I would not be able to compete equally with my peers and search for this house in a historically white suburb. On the other spectrum, they had a young man from the township and a social entrepreneur, if you wish. And he says, I got involved with the wrong crowd at a very early age. I was arrested for stealing a cell phone. I went to jail for some time. I came out. And when I came out, I found out about the National Youth Development Agency, which helps young entrepreneurs to set themselves up. And he has the mobile stand and he fries his chicken. And because he does this on a small capacity, he has to have good refrigeration. He has to have the ability to know when his meat is about to go off or not to go off. So he has to have good food understanding and things like that. And he got the support from the National Youth Development Agency to go and study this thing. This is from stealing a cell phone, going to jail, coming back to setting up your own little business. And I'm talking about these two extremes so that people don't only think that you're looking at the good side of the story. This one's had an opportunity to go to school. They made it. This one had only the policy framework to help him. And he took that chance. And for me, that's what is available for young entrepreneurs in South Africa. It's not about who you are, who you know, or where you come from, but it's about your passion, your zeal, and your commitment to make use of the infrastructure that is there.
And I was going to say, it sounds like there is an infrastructure there to take advantage of, which is key. I mean, you can have all of the enthusiasm in the world, but if there's nothing there to help you, it sounds like South Africa has taken that very seriously.
I will say this. One of the things that South Africa really did excellent was not to leave the youth outside of the freedom of victories. Once it became apparent that there was going to be a new government in South Africa, the opposition parties then against the apartheid came together and said, what do we do about the youth? Because these youth were key to bringing about this change. And it is because of those struggles of the youth that you had the establishment of the then National Youth Commission, which was responsible for advising government on youth development policies. And it had a three focus, if you wish. It had on education to make sure that young people had access to education and what they needed to do. It had a focus on social cohesion, and that it focused on service, creating service opportunities in our communities. Firstly, to serve our own communities, but secondly, to empower ourselves. Because one of the most frustrating experiences any young person can get is the question, do you have experience? I'm sure you've had this question even in the United States. A young person comes with a beautiful curriculum vitae, top marks from his class. They ask, where have you worked before? I just graduated last month. How could I have had a job? Nobody wants to take the risk. And youth service programs were trying to help young people to get that on-job training. And then there was the entrepreneurship position where you helped young people who didn't necessarily want to go and get a job but wanted to create their own jobs through having funding available for them, through having mentorship available for them. And then when we realized that the policy framework was not enough, we needed to have practical guidance, we established what we call the Umsobomvu Youth Fund, which was mainly focusing on entrepreneur development for young people. But we also came to a realization that you can't have 50 people talking about youth development as if they're not talking to each other. And that's why the National Youth Development Agency, because you took the policy initiatives, you took the economic initiatives and social cohesion, and you put them in one pot, and you said you are now responsible to make sure that policy environment is correct and conducive for young people to thrive in it. Economically, they not only have the policy support, but they have the economic back rolling. If a person wants to start a company, he can get a loan from you. But socially, they talk to each other, because there's no sense in you having the Africans talking in the other corner, the whites in the other corner, and these young people not talking to each other. And that's why this cultural infusion, if you wish, if you're looking at the boundaries, because they are forced to talk to each other.
In the next 20 years, what do you hope for your country?
Three things in the next 20 years. Increase in education institutions, especially higher learning education institutions, and especially focusing in the STEM area. We know, and everybody knows, that South Africa is great at mineral resources, but what we lack in is the beneficiation of those resources. So if we could have institutions, and part of the things that I go out, one of my passions when I go out to meet universities is to find out if they have programs that deal with beneficiation and production of raw material, and see how we can take that back to South Africa. Secondly, is to see South African young people travel and conquer the world. Not only do I want them to come to the United States for a year or for 2 years, but I want them to come here, imbue the United States with who South Africa is, the people of South Africa. And I always say to people, it's easy to get tourists over to South Africa. It's easy to get an exchange program to South Africa for 3 weeks. I'm not looking for that. I'm looking for sustainability. If you're going to enter into agreement with South Africa, at least tell me that we are planning for the next 3 years. Don't say, I don't want to have one tick on my box that, yes, I got 10 students over to South Africa. I want to say I got an agreement between the University of Wisconsin and the University of Cape Town that for the next 3 years, they will be shuttling students between each other. And these are the areas that they'll be focusing on. So I don't just want South Africans to come out, but I want them to welcome the world back into South Africa. Thirdly, I want South Africa to be the tourist destination. My country is beautiful. And I tell people, I'm a salesperson. If you ask me what I sell South Africa. My country is beautiful. My people are beautiful. But the only way you can find that out is if you go to the people of South Africa. Not what the media tells you. Not where people refer you to because they've been in Johannesburg for 2 hours and they say it's the best place in the world, or they've been in Cape Town for 3 hours. Go to where the people are, meet the people, live with that people, and get bitten by the South African bug. And I promise you, you will get back on that flight to the United States, but you will not finish a year without going back to South Africa.
Well, I'm looking forward to going because I haven't been yet. And I very much, it's been a place I've wanted to go for years. And you have convinced me even more that I want to do it.
Thank you.
So, Madam Consul General, it has been such a pleasure having you in the studio. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for the beautiful conversation.
Bushwa Tulelo is Consul General of South Africa in the Midwest, based in Chicago. She spoke with Bonnie North on a recent visit to Milwaukee to speak at UWM's South African Freedom Day event. Since a lightning-fast start, the Milwaukee Brewers have been on a bit of a downhill trajectory of late. We'll find out whether there's cause for concern in Brewers Nation when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. All the pieces of the puzzle seem to be in place for the Milwaukee Brewers throughout April. They had the best record in baseball, and the question marks about their pitching had all been answered with exclamation points. But baseball is far longer than a one-month game, and things have come coasting back towards reality in recent days. Howie Magner is our regular sports contributor. He writes the Sports Nut column for Milwaukee Magazine's website and is senior editor at the magazine. Howie, welcome back to the show.
It's always a pleasure to be here.
How concerned should we be about the Brewers' recent struggles?
Well, I think you can take it one of two ways. You can look at, they're in a slump, and obviously you never want to be in a slump, and you'd like to get out of that slump as soon as possible. There are some contributing factors to the recent skid. I think the loss of Ryan Braun from the lineup has certainly hurt. The offense has not nearly been as effective lately as it was early in the season, but it has a lot to do with timing as well, because at about the same time that Ryan Braun went out of the lineup, Aramis Ramirez, the cleanup hitter and third baseman, really cooled off, and he had gotten off to a scalding start early in the season. He was really their best hitter, and I believe he's something like 3 for his last 36. So you kind of take that 1-2 punch where you're losing your 3-hole hitter and your 4-hole hitter, and then nobody else in the lineup has really picked up that slack on a consistent basis. So the offense has struggled a little bit. Is that cause for a long-term concern? Well, it depends. It depends on if you think this Ryan Braun oblique injury is going to be a lingering thing, or if you think the 15-day disabled list stint will cure him of his ills and he'll be okay when he comes back. There's some conjecture on which end of the spectrum that's going to fall. I myself would be a little concerned with a rib cage injury
oblique
like that.
Oblique injuries tend to stick
around. They are notorious for, being okay and then not being okay and then being okay and then flaring up again. And so you have to wonder, especially with a guy whose game is based a lot on power like Braun's is, whether or not that's going to be a concern throughout the season. With Ramirez, you figure, look, the guy's a veteran. He's a professional hitter. It's just a stretch where he's struggling a little bit. He actually got hit on the elbow in a game recently, and that might be a contributing factor as well. But he hasn't mentioned any concerns about health. You figure it's just a stretch, and he'll be okay going forward once he gets out of the funk.
The point has been made that this is a 162-game season. There are going to be stretches where teams are going to lose more than they win.
I have heard those rumors, and I believe them to be true. But what this really goes to show from my perspective is how important that hot start was for the Brewers, because it gave them such a comfortable cushion that they are able to absorb stretches like this and still be in a relatively good spot. I mean, the Cardinals, as of Wednesday, had trimmed their division lead to 4 games, which is still a nice, comfortable margin when you're looking at May. Winning percentage-wise, the Brewers are no longer the best team in baseball. That honor belongs to the Tigers, who I think have a .690 winning percentage with a 20-9 record, and the Brewers are at 22-13. And a couple of National League teams are catching up to them. The Rockies have been very hot lately. The Giants have been very hot lately. But in the grand scheme of things, the Brewers are still in a pretty good situation. You have faith in their starting rotation going forward. They've still been pitching quite well. So you aren't concerned about that. Their bullpen, while it's regressed a little bit, you expected that regression because they were pitching so well early on in the season that you just knew they had to come back to earth a little bit. At some point, Francisco Rodriguez will allow a run during the season. We're pretty sure of that. You also were sure about that with regards to Will Smith and Tyler Thornburg, and that has happened. So they've had some growing pains. Brandon Kinsler, who was on the disabled list for a little bit, has not pitched as well since he's come off the disabled list. But in the grand scheme of things, this is not a cause for panic. The Brewers are still a very good team. They're not as good as they were in April. They're not as bad as they've been recently. They'll settle somewhere in the middle.
Well, and so on perhaps a more personal note, you have been to many, many, many baseball games
yes.
in your life. Just this past week, there was a milestone. You attended a Brewers game, a baseball game of any kind, for the first time as a parent. How was that experience different for you than when you go with a perhaps more critical eye as a journalist?
Yeah, for those who aren't aware, my wife and I recently adopted 2 children from Haiti. And while soccer is very big down there and basketball is somewhat big, there's not a lot of baseball down there. But when we got back, of course, I'm watching baseball games on TV. We've got a bat and a ball with a wiffle bat and a foam ball in the backyard. And so my son Ray and particular got into baseball and eventually started saying he'd like to go see a baseball game. So yesterday was really the first time where the schedule worked out, and we thought he was comfortable enough, and we thought Dorothy wasn't quite ready from a patient standpoint to hang out at a ball game. So she went out to a farm with my wife, and they fed chickens and sheep and things. But I went to the ball game with Ray, and it really is a different experience because you're not watching it even from an adult fan standpoint or from a sports writer standpoint, but you're really watching the game through a child's eyes, and that really does put a different spin on things. And they are fascinated by things that you have taken for granted forever. And let me tell you something. This kid must be the luckiest kid when it comes to baseball that I've ever seen, because he's been to one baseball game his entire life. He's already gotten a free baseball. At the end of the ball game, we were out by the Diamondbacks bullpen, and we were watching their closer warm up, and so I lifted him above the wall just to get a better view. And the bullpen coach, I think it was the bullpen coach, Mel Stottlemyre, looked up and saw and tossed a ball up. And so Ray's one for one when it comes to free baseballs at ball games. But it really was a neat experience, and I'm sure it will be the first of many. And if you haven't taken a kid to a baseball game, I highly recommend that you do it.
Well, I should really ask him this question, but what was the stuff that fascinated him the most?
You know, the stuff that you would probably expect and that you wouldn't expect from your eyes, but he loved the racing sausages, of course. He loved Bernie Brewer. He loved playing on the playground equipment that they've got there at this stadium. And really, if you haven't been with kids, the Brewers do a great job of making it a family atmosphere. The ball game, look, he doesn't know the ball game, you know, inside and outside much at all. We watched maybe four innings of the game, and the rest of the time was just spent taking it all in. But he loved the stuff that you would expect kids to love, the active stuff, the mascot stuff, the sausage race he really loved. He's drawing pictures of Polish, the racing sausage, because that's the one that he picked out in the souvenir store and that he loves now. So he's a big Polish sausage fan, probably more so than any of the players on the team.
Not so much the two-seam fastball versus the four-seamer.
No, we're working on teaching him a cutter maybe over 30 years from now.
Well, speaking of developing interest, this is a horrible transition, but we're having this conversation. It's Thursday. The Packers are about to go into the NFL draft and make their first pick. We don't know who that will be just yet as we have the conversation, but there's much of the draft yet to come today and tomorrow. And the first round will not address all of the Packers' needs, so let's talk about what the Packers' primary needs are as they go into this draft season.
The easy answer would be they have to get better on defense, and I think you're not going to argue with that point based on how they've been defensively the last few years. They addressed that a little bit with the free agent signing of Julius Peppers, the talented pass rusher who they picked up after he left the Chicago Bears. But that's not going to fill all their needs on defense. A lot of people think they still need another pass rusher, perhaps out of the linebacking spot. Their secondary hasn't been the best, particularly at the safety position. And they could probably use another cornerback, frankly. So I have to believe that the bulk of their focus is going to be on the defensive end of the football. Now, whether or not they've addressed that in the first round, look, even if they do get another guy on defense, there are enough needs that they'll probably be focusing on that as the draft continues. But you can't ignore the offensive side of the ball either. They've had some losses in the offseason. James Jones, the very talented receiver, left as a free agent. JerMichael Finley, the tight end, who was basically another wide receiver for Aaron Rodgers, is also not with the team anymore. So those are two positions that you could certainly see Ted Thompson mining the draft for. But, I also think that they might look at some help on the offensive line, too, because while it's been okay, I don't know that people are still convinced that David Bakhtiari at left tackle is a franchise left tackle. And you have concerns about Brian Bulaga coming back from injury, and they're always looking for help at the center position because it seems they keep going through those guys like water bottles. I mean, I think Aaron Rodgers is going to be on his fourth center in the past 3 years or something like that. So if somebody falls to them there, then that could be a position position that they address. But overall, I think if you're not going to lose any money if you place a bet that says their main focus is going to be on the defensive side of the ball.
Well, and Julius Peppers notwithstanding, this is a team that mainly, almost universally, is constructed of guys that they have drafted. So you have to believe that the people that they draft are the ones that they're you know, stuck with for good or bad.
Yeah, I mean, Ted Thompson is notorious for valuing his draft picks, and some would say overvaluing them at the expense of not going out and addressing needs in the free agent market. The Peppers signing was a bit of an aberration in that it was a splashy free agent signing that Thompson used to address an immediate need. Usually he prefers to do that through the draft, and there's a reason for that. You get these guys when they're young, you can mold them into your system, and you've got them at a more team-friendly price for a longer period of time, and you're not burning your salary cap. But look, there's a risk there too, because if you're going to rely so heavily on the draft and not use the tools of free agency to build your team, then you'd better get it right in the draft. And so there's always a little extra pressure, I think, on the Packers to get things right in the draft than most other teams. And basically, it's because of Ted Thompson's philosophy in general.
Well, and I think we always get it right here.
I don't know about that, Mitch. You might want to take a poll.
Howie, thanks.
Thanks, Mitch. Take care.
Howie Magner writes the Sports Nut column for Milwaukee Magazine's website. He's senior editor at the magazine, and he is our regular sports contributor. For some people, summer is about baseball, whether it's playing it or watching it. For others, they just can't wait for the summer movie season to begin. We'll have a preview when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Tyke. Yesterday's weather, at least for a while, had us thinking about summer. Eventually, it'll be warm all the time, and perhaps that's what it'll take to send you to an air-conditioned movie theater. Summer is often the season for blockbusters, and some of them have arrived already. There are more to come, though, and our movie contributor Dave Lurson joins us now for a summer movie preview. Lurson talked with Lake Effect's Dan Harmon about what's here and what's on the way.
Blockbuster season started early this year with Captain America, The Winter Soldier, and The Amazing Spider-Man 2 hard on its heels. More of those are on the way, including Transformers Age of Extinction and yet another stab at Godzilla. But if superheroes and computer-generated mayhem aren't your pleasure, don't despair. The summer movie season will provide alternatives.
You're not looking forward to seeing X-Men?
Well, X-Men, I could add that to Bryan Singer, you know, is an interesting director who's done good work in the past. Am I looking forward to it? I mean, I have to just be honest that I have not, you know, been this hardened detractor of all superhero movies. I'm not a dyed-in-the-wool hater of all movies based on Marvel or DC Comics. I've written favorable reviews of quite a few movies of these sorts in the past. But I'm a little tired of them right now. I think we've had a deluge of them. The public appetite doesn't seem to be sated for it yet. I think we will continue to see more and more of them as long as people will buy tickets. But at the moment, I'm feeling superhero fatigue. But, you know, X-Men, you know, that may be a very fine movie. I try not to let these things cloud my judgment once I sit down and watch the picture.
Well, there's not many sci-fi slash blockbusters that have Patrick Stewart and Ian McKellen in them.
Well, what great actors. I mean, you know, even if the rest of the movie turns out to be poorly written, dependent on cheesy computer-generated imagery, you still have those two guys. So, yeah, I mean, there's going to be something there to like.
All right. You have a not impressively large list of movies you think are worth seeing this summer. What's your first one?
Yeah, well, I think to start out with, it's coming to Milwaukee very soon, Belle. This is based on a true story about the mixed-race daughter of a black woman and a British aristocrat in the 18th century. Tom Wilkinson, Matthew Good, there are some of these people that in the cast that turn up in a lot of British productions. Costume dramas particularly. There's a newcomer, and I'm probably not going to pronounce her name correctly, who is in the starring role, Guju Mbatha Raw, I believe. I'm probably hopefully close to saying her name correctly. This looks like an interesting film historically because it gets into the idea. It's a Jane Austen type of thing with all these navigating the social mores and the wealthy and the marriageability aspects of it. It's like Pride and Prejudice with an emphasis on prejudice, you could say. And it shows that in many respects in Britain, class trumped race as being the defining factor. I mean, this woman was not accorded full equality to her whiter cousins, but she was, you know, part of the upper class nonetheless, whether some people liked it or not.
Well, at this point, I think I feel about, and I'm air quoting here, period pieces, the way you feel about blockbusters and or sci-fi. So does this break the mold in any way of the PBS type period piece?
Well, dealing with an interesting issue. Again, I have not had time to check into the historicity, to use a big word, of this production. But apparently, you know, something like this story did really happen. And race and slavery were big topics in 18th century England. There was a court ruling at the time saying that slavery was not legal in England itself, even though in colonies it could be. But so there were steps being made at that time toward a more progressive view of things, and this movie deals with that. I don't think, aside from, 12 Years a Slave, I guess, you know, set in the 19th century, but I haven't seen a period movie dealing with exactly this topic, so it will be something a little different.
Okay. Well, let's just completely change genres and talk about Woody Allen's summer offering.
Well, this is also, I guess you're not going to like this one either. It's a period movie set in the French Riviera during the 1920s, a romantic comedy. Colin Firth is trying to debunk what he considers to be a fake psychic played by Emma Stone. He falls in love with her. Woody Allen made the humorous remark that he's become a foreign filmmaker now, a European filmmaker, because his source of funding is coming from Europe now. So he's making movies there. And we've talked about this before on this program. Really, you know, getting out of Manhattan and going to Europe has been the greatest thing he's done for himself in decades, because it has definitely enlivened his creative spark.
I think San Francisco counts as a foreign country to him.
Well, for him it is, definitely. San Francisco, yeah, that's nothing like Manhattan.
All right. And, well, the last movie that Philip Seymour Hoffman will appear in is also going to start this. Well, when does that start?
Well, that's a summertime movie, okay. A Most Wanted Man, based on a John Le Carré novel. I believe that Seymour Hoffman's role was virtually completed at the time of his unexpected death. It's not the absolute final film appearance by him. I think there's something else rattling around out there that's going to emerge from the pipeline. But this may be the final significant movie where he's, you know, the key player. He plays a German intelligence operative tracking Islamist terrorists in Hamburg. So it has all the makings of a very good film. It sounds like it has a good screenplay. And Philip Seymour Hoffman, I mean, he was such a tragedy. He was by far the great male actor of his generation. And, you know, was he ever in a mediocre movie? Yes, a couple of times. But for the most part, he was always something to look at in any film he appeared in.
And something else this summer that when I saw it, I know about it, but I was reading about it and thinking, wow, again, Planet of the Apes, that's coming out pretty soon. I think that's, July 11th.
Well, that sounds like something that I might not like on the basis of my suspicion of rebooting old franchises simply to milk the proceeds from that. But I was pleasantly surprised by the 2011 Planet of the Apes movie. It was an interesting take, kind of an origin story on the whole thing. And Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, scheduled for this summer, picks up where that story left off. The apes are really ascendant. At this point, there still are some humans holding on out there. I don't give them too much hope, I guess, but we'll see what happens with them. Andy Serkin, the guy familiar from Golem and the Lord of the Rings movies, is playing a prominent role in this film. And animal rights people will be happy that really the apes are otherwise computer generated.
Wow. All right. Something that caught my eye this summer that I just thought was unusual is Jersey Boys, which a musical, not only a musical, but a film musical, which, you know, it doesn't really appear that often.
Well, this musical was a runaway hit on Broadway and beyond. It's been on tour. It's won Tonys. And, I mean, a lot of Broadway musicals in recent years have come out of Hollywood movies. The reverse flow has been occurring. Mm-hmm. And here we have something going back to the real old tradition that you have a successful Broadway musical that then is turned into a Hollywood movie. Clint Eastwood, who seems, to me anyway, an odd choice to direct a musical, but then again, maybe he likes the Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons era in some way and relates to that. I don't know what his thinking was, but it's going to be something different. And I think because this musical is so popular, it's done such great business that it probably will be a success at movie box offices too.
I know one film on your list that I was a little surprised by because maybe I'm just being closed-minded about it, but The Fault in Our Stars. You think this is going to be kind of a teen hit, a 20-something hit this summer?
Oh, I think so. I mean, unless the screenplay really aggravates the core audience by deviating from it somehow, this has become a great concern for directors and screenwriters and producers making successful novels into movies. I mean, look at all the care of not offending any Harry Potter fan during the series of Harry Potter movies and concern over Hunger Games fans rejecting any version of that. This is the same kind of thing. There's really an intense audience for the novel. The young adult novel was not only a bestseller, which is one thing, but it seems to be a bestseller that the readers really care deeply about and relate to in some level. Funny, kind of sweet, sad story about two young people who fall in love. They meet at a cancer support group. So my suspicion is that unless the screenplay really blows it somehow, that this is going to be a big movie this summer.
Is that unusual for this kind of movie to be a summer hit? Doesn't sound like the happiest movie
it's
in the
not
world.
The happiest movie, I suppose, but yet there's all the resilience of the human spirit going on there. It's not I'm sure it's not going to be a mopey sad sack kind of a thing either. They can't take that to the extreme. Unusual? I don't know. I think it's kind of a more intelligent alternative to things like Hercules, for example, which stacks up to be a really terrible movie cashing in on the success of 300. And now we have to mine ancient Greek mythology for, you know, bad CGI-driven film. So I think for people younger people who are looking for something a little more moving and intelligent, this would be a good alternative for them.
And a couple of minutes ago, you mentioned Harry Potter, and there is a movie out this summer with Daniel Radcliffe, and of course he's tried quite a few things since Harry Potter, and is he now dabbling in the romantic comedy genre?
Well, why not? I mean, the challenge for him was not to be eternally typecast, especially if you're eternally typecast as a young character. I mean, look at, you know, Shirley Temple comes to mind. She didn't have much of a success going into teenage, much less adulthood in the movies. So he began really early, you know, doing stage productions, Equus, for example, that totally, you know, would shred his Harry Potter image. So, yeah, he's dabbling around doing different things. He's talented. I think he has a long career ahead of him. And I think that he is pursuing it with the recognition that I'm probably never going to be sitting on top of anything that's as deep a gold mine as Harry Potter again. So why try to compete with that? I'm going to maybe even, you know, take on small roles like the horror film he was in about a year ago, kind of an interesting low-key movie, romantic comedy, why not? He did that movie about William Burroughs and Jack Kerouac about a year ago. So, yeah, he's probably made his money. He's a good actor. He wants to pursue a career. He's got many years, hopefully, ahead of him. And I think he's in a position where he can choose interesting roles.
All right. And that movie is called What If? And we have time for just one more. Something kind of an indie movie, I guess, would be Begin Again.
Begin Again, yes. Begin Again in not only indie filmmaking, but the indie music scene. Begin Again stars Keira Knightley as a declining, I guess, British singer, songwriter, and Mark Ruffalo as a one-time successful music industry person who's, you know, the change of the industry from you know, CDs to MP3s has totally left him, you know, out to lunch. These two people are flailing around, failing, and they meet each other when they're at the bottom and something happens, I guess. I mean, it's probably, it sounds like an interesting look at the state of the film industry. The director, John Carney, made a little bit of an impression a few years ago with an indie film about music again called Once. It got an Oscar for Best Song that year, and he's going back to not exactly the same territory, but something a little bit similar for this movie with the casting of it. It could be a modest success.
Well, it looks like there's quite a bit to see this summer. It's not quite the lacking summer that we've had recently.
Yeah, I would always argue that the summers are never a complete wasteland. I mean, you know, if you just look at what's in the top five, sometimes it would seem that way. But if you look around a little bit deeper in a city like Milwaukee, where we have the Downer and Oriental Theater and other venues from time to time, you can find something.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Dave.
Thank you.
Dave Lurson is arts and entertainment editor for the Shepherd Express weekly newspaper, author of its I Hate Hollywood blog, and our regular film contributor. He talked with Dan Harmon. One last break, and then ahead of Mother's Day, a mom considers her image. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. If you haven't checked your calendar, let me remind you that Mother's Day is this Sunday. Cards, phone calls, flowers, they're all called for. In my case, Mother's Day and my mom's birthday are always within a couple of days of each other, which keeps the Hallmark people happy. Whether your mom is still living or not, most of us have a particular fixed image or two of our mom that comes to mind from some point in life. As Lake Effect essayist Marie O'Brien has learned, sometimes managing that image is a tricky business.
The kids and I stared at the computer, watching the download bar creep across the screen. It was the middle of winter, and we were waiting to relive our summer at the lake by finally scrolling through the hundreds of pictures that had been stored on my camera. We talked of warm, sunny days, their dad grilling, me driving the boat and pulling them on a tube for hours on end. Then the computer chirped and we started to scroll. We clicked through photo after photo of the kids, family, and friends. About 100 pictures in, a close-up flashed on screen. "There you are, Mom," my son said with surprise, since I'm usually taking the photos, not appearing in them. "Who is this? That can't be me. This isn't the person I'd imagined as we shared summer stories." I surveyed the image of this familiar stranger, sitting on the boat, hair blowing wildly in all directions, smiling and squinting in the sun. What I saw was uneven skin tone, lack of makeup, and wrinkles, lots of them. The lyrics from Rod Stewart's Maggie May popped into my head. "The morning sun, when it's in your face, really shows your age." The person in the photo looked a lot older than I did, by at least 20 years. I muttered something about it being an awful picture and moved the cursor to delete. My preteen and teen daughters both shouted in unison, "Mom, no!" "Mom, don't delete that," my 14-year-old son said with a surprising adult-like sternness. My finger hovered over the mouse, ready to click. "Why would you delete it?" my oldest daughter asked. I looked again at myself on that bright, high-resolution megapixel screen. What should I say? That this wasn't the 30-year-old I had trapped in my mind staring back at us, so I needed to delete her? That everything I lectured to them about beauty on the inside and Photoshop-frenzied images was just not true? That beauty is only skin deep? That I needed a Photoshop session? Yes, I really needed one. "I just don't like it," was all I could muster. It's a great picture of you, though, she said. My finger twitched. And I was pulled into a moment when I was 9 or 10 years old, looking through a stack of pictures with my mom. I had found a black and white photo of Mom standing with her sisters. Mom was hugely pregnant. She took one look and said, "Oh, God, that is simply awful. I look terrible." I didn't understand. It was just a picture of Mom with my aunts, and she was pregnant. Mom picked up the picture and promptly tore it up. "Why did you do that?" my voice shocked into a shout. "Because it's just a bad picture of me." I looked at myself on the screen, and I started to see. I was focusing on the wrong details. The wind is blowing my hair. I am not posed. The sunlight means it was a beautiful summer day, and I look, well, relaxed and happy. I am smiling. I thought of the photograph of Mom, torn to pieces. There were probably a dozen awful details she saw in that photo, but I remember the important one. It couldn't have been a bad picture, because I remember she was smiling too.
Lake Effect essayist Marie O'Brien is a freelance writer in Brookfield, and because you're curious, you can see the picture of her that inspired that essay at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. That's Friday's edition of the program, brought to you by a friendly team of producers, including Bonnie North, Dan Harmon, and Stephanie Lecce, with production assistance from Eleanor Peterson, web support from Michelle Maternowski, and studio engineering from John Strelecki. I'm Mitch Tyke. Enjoy whatever the weather throws our way this weekend, and I hope we will be a part of it as well. Lake Effect Weekend comes your way tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. It's 11 o'clock. Stay tuned. Fresh Air is next, and then it's Here and Now at noon.